طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Pham and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States, especially from the mainstream media. On today's show, we feature the October 30th broadcast of The Voice of Palestine, hosted by Hana Kawas, that interviews writer and journalist Ben Norton, who talks about the structural racism against Palestinians in Israel and the United States. Ben Norton is a writer and journalist. His work has been published in Counterpunch, Electronic Intifada, Common Dreams, Think Progress, and ZNet, among other publications. His website can be found at bennorton.com. Follow him on Twitter at Benjamin Norton. And here it is.
Welcome to another edition of The Voice of Palestine. It's October 30th, 2014, and I'm your co-host, Hanna Kawas. This week, we are talking with Ben Norton, an American freelance writer, artist, and activist. His work has been published in Counterpunch, Electronic Intifada, Common Dreams, Think Progress, and ZNet, among other publications. One of his recent articles was about an attack on a young Palestinian woman by Zionists in Brooklyn. Good afternoon, Ben, and welcome to The Voice of Palestine.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
To start with, could you tell us a bit about yourself and why you are interested in the basically the Palestinian human rights and national liberation and the racism in specific in the U.S. and in Palestine?
Yes, I got into Palestinian solidarity activism simply kind of as an outgrowth of my work as an all-around intersectional left-wing activist. I'm a leftist, and I've been involved in a lot of different anti-imperialist solidarity work and anti-racist work. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, when I first got into activism, I didn't really know much about Palestine, but of course I knew that kind of the locus of imperialism in the past 50 years has been in the Middle East and North Africa. And when I first started learning about the situation in Palestine, the settler colonialism and the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, I learned how this, in a lot of ways, is kind of at the center of imperialism, of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East, of racism, of settler colonialism and things like that. And in a lot of ways, it's an extension of national indigenous rights movement. So as a left-wing activist, I just saw Palestine as such an important and enormous issue, and understood that I have to, as an American, do what I can to stand in solidarity with Palestinians to prevent my government, as an American citizen, to prevent my government from continuing to oppress them and continuing to fund the state of Israel that, you know, has colonized them for 67 years and occupied them illegally for 47 years. Mm-hmm. You know, U.S. tax dollars fund the occupation, and they fund this process of colonialism in the sum of $3.1 billion per year. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Haaretz released a recent article in August saying that in the past 50 years, the U.S. military aid to Israel is approximately $100 billion. So really just this congruence and summation of all of these factors, just shouted out to me and said, you know, as an American anti-imperialist and left-wing activist and anti-racist activist, Palestine is one of the most important issues you can work on. And former President Carter himself has said in 2007, this is one of the largest human rights issues of today. The occupation of Palestine and the siege on Gaza is simply one of the worst atrocities going on in the world, and mm-hmm. we have a moral responsibility to do what we can to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians in their fight for justice and liberation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned the $100 billion. That's the official aid, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
just military aid, too.
Yeah, yeah, which doesn't include the tax-deductible portion, because the GNF, for example, has tax deduction, which is basically comes out of the pockets of the taxpayers in the U.S.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've seen recent article in Haaretz where they said that there is conflict between GNF and the Israeli government over who to get the money from the sales of the land that the GNF takes, but they've been giving it to them basically it's funding the Israeli government because any money that goes from the GNF to the Israeli government is tax deductible, you know, whether in the US and Canada here is the same story, it's tax deductible. Actually, our Prime Minister Harper here, he attends GNF functions, at least Obama doesn't. Does he? Or I'm mistaken.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, also another interesting issue that perhaps you can talk to more is Canadian complicity in this process, because as Americans, unfortunately, we often tend to ignore the role of Canadian politics, but especially with the far-right Harper government and the increasing diehard Zionism present in the Canadian political system, that's an enormous factor that people forget about in the U.S.
Before really I ask you about the specific case which really trying to highlight the Nardine Keshwani, the attack on her by Zionist thugs in Brooklyn, I want to ask you, you had a recent article, I think, about... what was it? Just today, I believe, about what happened at the block the boat, and
I can talk about that.
Yeah, can you talk about that and show the it's not just against Palestinians, the racism. It shows that they are racist. Period. Not just against Palestinian. It flows from the ideology of supremacism that the Zionist was built on. Don't you think?
Exactly. And my article was actually published this morning in Mondo Weiss. I write regularly for Mondo Weiss. And the article was titled, quote, "Take your Ebola ASS and get out," end quote, and then subtitled, "LA Confrontation Highlights Relationship Between Zionism and Anti-Black Racism." Mm-hmm. And in the article, I talk about this horrific, horrific incident on the 18th of this month, the 18th of October, in which a group of Zionist counter-protesters at a Block the Boat action in Los Angeles. And Block the Boat is a new, amazing movement that's kind of taking control in the U.S. and actually worldwide. And it's really pushing forward the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement. And what Block the Boat calls for is preventing Israeli cargo ships from unloading in American ports. And I actually have an article about this also in Mondo Weiss from a few weeks ago. It's called California Takes the Lead in the Black the Boat Movement, I believe, to make that effect. And in it, I talk about the efficacy of this movement and how much of a positive development it is. But anyway, so in my article this morning, I talk about how this group of Zionist counter-protesters at this Black the Boat action on the 18th, one of the members of the Zionist counter-protesters called a black Palestinian solidarity activist from the U.S. She called her, she accused her of having Ebola, and she said, you know, "Take your Ebola ASS and get out." That's her exact quote. Mm-hmm. And then this solidarity activist, who is a civil rights activist, Margaret Prescott, who is also a well-known radio personality in Los Angeles, and she hosts a show called Sojourner Truth, and she talks about the global feminist struggle, the anti-racist struggle, and anti-imperialism, and connects them all together. Well, this Zionist activist told Margaret Prescott, "Take your Ebola ASS and get out." Mm-hmm. And Prescott who, you know, was aghast at the overt racism, said, Ebola, that's racist. You're saying that because I'm a black American, I'm part of Ebola? That's a racist. And then the Zionist counter-protester went a step further and explicitly said, quote, yes, I am racist. Step the F-U-C-K out. Yes, I am racist. She explicitly identified as a racist.
Yeah.
And then in the article, I talk about, you know, there's other racist interactions. There's a part later where the Zionist counter-protester accuses black people of being responsible for all the crime in the U.S., etc. So this incident really is a kind of synecdoche, is a kind of an embodiment of the racism that is fundamentally at the heart of Zionism. So I spend the rest of the article talking about how this racism is symptomatic of Zionism in general and how it echoes Israeli society. And I talk about the forced sterilization of Ethiopian Jews. I talk about the incident several months ago in which a member of Knesset, who is a Jew of Ethiopian descent, her blood was denied by the Israeli equivalent of the Red Cross because they said that she might have AIDS. And she was raised in Israel. She's been in Israel since she was 3 years old. She doesn't have AIDS. It's ridiculous. But there's just this intense racism against anyone that it doesn't fit into the frankly white supremacist Ashkenazi conception of Judaism. Even Mizrahi Jews in Israeli society are often incredibly discriminated against. And in the 70s, people might know that there is a spinoff of the Black Panthers in the late 70s and 80s in Israel that was also called the Black Panthers, and it was based on Mizrahi rights.
Yeah.
So in this article, I just talk about how, you know, Zionism is not just racist against Palestinians. It is a fundamentally racist ideology, and it is a fundamentally colonialist ideology. And, you know, people might know that Theodor Herzl, the father of Zionism, in his diaries, he spoke of it as colonial, and he wrote a letter to Cecil Rhodes, one of the bloodiest colonialists in human history, the British mineral magnate. Herzl wrote a letter to Rhodes calling Zionism something colonial. That's the exact quote, something colonial. And he asked Cecil Rhodes for advice on how to colonize Palestine. So really, in my article, I go in great detail. I draw from Max Blumenthal's work and David Sheen's work and their documentary about anti-African racism in Israel. I also draw Leah Tarachansky, who is a great anti-Zionist Israeli journalist. She has this ridiculous, this grotesque footage of African refugees in what are effectively Israeli concentration camps. And the African refugees try to leave the camp where they're told they supposedly can leave. They try to leave, and the Israeli military prevents them violently from leaving. And then in response to that, the African refugee is going hunger strike. So really, in Israel, we're seeing just some of the most intense and virulent and violent forms of racism. And it's not something that's just limited to the Palestinians. More and more people are realizing that this is something that affects all people of color. This is something that affects African refugees. And this is something that cannot continue to persist because it is fundamentally unjust.
Yeah. Actually, you mentioned about how the objective of the Zionist movement was the colonization of Palestine, and this is stated really, Ben, in their first Zionist Congress as one of their objectives, you know, the colonization of Palestine. They didn't really mince meat in the first Zionist Congress, which was held in 1897. If you go and read their objectives, you know, they say,
exactly.
Yeah, they say clearly it's the colonization of
Palestine. Even almost 50 years later, with the formation of the State of Israel, some of the leading founders were explicit about their racism and colonialism. And you don't need to just point to the Stern Gang and Irgun and the fact that, you know, leaders of those literal Jewish fascist organizations became heads of state in the case of Menachem Begin and others.
Yeah.
But even David Ben-Gurion, even he pretty explicitly says, we must force out the Palestinians and prevent them from returning. And this is all incredibly well documented in Ilan Pappé's amazing masterpiece, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I mean, it's just explicit, and it's been explicit, but people, they don't read this history, and there's a reason they don't read the history. It's because, one, they're taught to hate history, or they're not really taught history at all, and two, because the history that is presented is so distorted and slanted that people don't even think that it exists.
Struck me too also about your today's article, it wasn't really highlighted, but the black African woman went and told the police what happened, and they didn't do anything about it. And this looks like it occurs all the time. While if a Zionist cries anti-Semitism, they intervene immediately. Did you notice that in your research?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is an incredibly common trend, and this is something that black Americans and Americans of color and, you know, people of color around the world have been talking about for years and years and years. The police, in many ways, are also a very white supremacist institution. They, you know, until the 1950s, in the U.S., the police literally were a white supremacist institution, and still today, they very favorably treat white Americans. The Malcolm X grassroots research organization, they have released a study positing that every 28 hours in the U.S., a black man is killed by police or vigilantes. Mm-hmm. So there's this intense structural violence, this intense racist, white supremacist violence against Americans of color, and particularly black Americans, by police.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can see this in countless instances, but especially recently with the uprisings in Ferguson, with the murdering of Mike Brown, a young black teen, and the complete impunity of Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot him, even though there's audio evidence that shows Darren Wilson shot at Brown over 10 times and hit him 9 times. This intense violence is not punished. Police sometimes are even rewarded for it. So yes, this extends very far. And as soon as a white person shouts, you know, something, this bad thing happened, even when there's no evidence, the police come to their aid. A paragon of this, a prime example of this, is the story with Nardine Kiswani and Sean Currier, and I can talk about that a little bit more if you want.
Yeah, actually, it didn't have much coverage, not even in the social media, you know, let alone the corporate media. I didn't really see much talk about it, because it's really striking, the racism, the institutional racism also, in addition to the Zionist racism in it. And I'll ask you a bit more about the relation between them both later, but could you tell us a bit about what happened to Nardine Kiswani, please? And I know, you know, there is she's took her case to the courts, but if you could talk about where we are at and etc. But could you give us some background, what happened really, and the attacker, Leonard Pitlack, I believe. He's a professor of Jewish history who attacked her and tore the flag from her hand. And, you know, if you could give us detail how it happened, please.
Absolutely. So, actually, a week ago from today, I had another article in Rhonda Weiss, and this one was called Allegations of Anti-Semitism Used to Cover Up Anti-Palestinian Hate Crime in Brooklyn. And in this article, it's another really long article, I talk about an incident on 7 October, earlier this month, in which a young Palestinian woman who is a college student in New York City, she was at a basketball game in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center. And the game was between the Brooklyn Nets, the Brooklyn basketball team, and then an Israeli team called the Maccabi Electra Tel Aviv. And, at this game, most of the most of the attendees there were supporting Maccabi Electra Tel Aviv, and in that game, the young Palestinian woman, Nardine, she brought a Palestinian flag, and there's video footage of an incident that happens when the game is over. A group of middle-aged, kind of older Zionists, supporters of the Israeli team, one of which is a man by the name of Leonard Petlock. And Petlock is a professor at actually her same school, at Hunter College, part of the City University of New York. And he teaches the history of Soviet Jews and Russian Jews. And Petlock is also actually the first Russian-speaking vice president of the American Zionist movement. And his group harasses her. A member of the group goes up to her and pulls out the Palestinian flag. She wasn't even waving it. It was just in her hand. She had a flag, and one of them pulls her out, pulls it out of her hand. And Nardine alleges that the man also punched her in the stomach. And she wrote this, really kind of terrifying response on her Facebook wall, just talking about how this Zionist punched her in the stomach and stole her flag and things like that. And then she called the security and they wouldn't do anything. But then as soon as this group called security, they came over and said what is going on. And then there are numerous reports after. I interviewed some people who were there, and I interviewed some people who were protesting outside of the game. And many people talk about intense harassment of Nardine and others. And in fact, there are actually there are reported instances that night of sexual abuse by Zionists against Palestinian Solidarity activists. And actually, what's really interesting is Dave Zirin, who is a reporter for The Nation, on the night of the game, he went to Barclays to report on the protests. Because Zirin is a left-wing activist and writer and journalist who reports on sports, but from a leftist perspective. Mm-hmm. And he went to the game, and outside, while the game was going on, numerous organizations were protesting, including Jewish Voice for Peace, including Adala, including Students for Justice in Palestine, so a variety of groups. Some from anti-Zionist Jewish background, some from Palestinian background, and some from other backgrounds. And Zirin, he reported just intense violence directed against these activists. And he actually interviewed one of the pro-Israel counter-protesters, and he has this quote in his article, and it's like filled with like 10 F words. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredibly violent. So anyway, within this very violent atmosphere, with this virulent anti-Palestinian rhetoric going on and things like that, one of the activists, and it is not entirely clear who, although one was blamed for it, someone punches Petlock, who's a professor, mm-hmm. and punches him in the nose. And the media exploded at this. And instantly everyone blamed Sean Carrier, who was he was deeply involved in the Occupy movement, and he is also involved in Palestinian solidarity organizing, and he is a journalist. And in the subsequent witch hunt, that's what you have to call it, is essentially a witch hunt.
Yeah.
The witch hunt after is absolutely absurd. In the subsequent days after that incident in Barclays, the media in the U.S. and the Israeli media, you know, they made this story go viral. They reported that there was this alleged anti-Semitic hate crime, and that this young Occupy activist, Sean Carrier, punched this Jewish American leader of the American Zionist movement as an act of hate. No mention whatsoever was ever made of Nardine and of the men assaulting her before any of this even happened. They were minding their own business standing there, and they were assaulted first. So none of this is mentioned. In all of these publications, they completely jump to false conclusions, claiming that the attack on Petlock, the vice president of the American Zionist Movement, was a hate crime. And what they do to verify the supposed claim is they interview him. They don't interview anyone else there. They interview just Leonard Petluck. And they also include ridiculous quotes of him saying things like, this is a ridiculous anti-Semitic hate crime. It should encourage you to support Israel. And he tells people to volunteer to join the IDF. Mm-hmm. So not only are they reporting this ridiculous story for which there is virtually no evidence, they're also giving him a platform to inspire people to join the Israeli occupation force.
Yeah.
But then it goes even further. Like the story, when I was researching and interviewing people, it just got more and more ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Well, in the subsequent days, in the wake of this, in this violent skirmish, Sean Carrier, the activist who was accused of the crime, he was in Ferguson, speaking of Ferguson, he was in Ferguson, Missouri, reporting on police clampdowns on civil rights activists. And these clampdowns have also been ridiculous and egregious, and they're shooting out, you know, tear gas for people who are just standing in the street demanding justice for a young teen who was killed by a police officer. But anyway, so Sean was reporting on this around 950 miles away, almost 1,000 miles away from Brooklyn, and then he gets arrested for that misdemeanor. It's not even a serious crime. It's a misdemeanor, and he gets flown all the way back to Brooklyn, where he's put in jail awaiting people to hear the case. Mm-hmm. So this is just like, it is extreme beyond belief. Mm-hmm. Not only is the person who was actually attacked in the first place, Nardine, not only is her story completely covered up, it gets even worse. The person who was complicit, the person who was a member of the group, although he himself might have done it, Petluck was a member of the group who harassed Nardine. Yeah. He is the one who, when he gets punched, he is the one who claims it was an attack on him, even though they initiated the violence, obviously. Yeah. And then the person who is blamed for this ridiculous hate crime for which there is no evidence gets flown from 1,000 miles away for a minor crime for which there is no evidence back to Brooklyn. It is like, it's like a weird Hollywood movie. Yeah. And when he was taken back to Brooklyn, the NYPD, their task force on hate crimes, determined that there was no evidence whatsoever for the hate crime allegation, and he was never even charged. Mm-hmm. So throughout this process, a lot of media sources have been falsely presenting the aspect of the story. I spoke with Lamise Deek, who is actually the lawyer of both Sean Carrier and Nardine Kiswani. And Lamise, a human rights lawyer of Palestinian descent who's in New York City, mm-hmm. she explained that Sean was actually never even charged with a hate crime. It's just the media blew it out of proportion. They claimed things they didn't have any evidence for, and they just completely lied. And really, this, like you said, this story has almost not made it at all into the mainstream media. There have been a few local New York publications that have released stories clarifying that, yes, there is no evidence of the hate crime, it's not a hate crime, and mentioning Nardine's the harassment of Nardine. But for the most part, Haaretz, the Jewish Daily Forward, and numerous other publications which publish stories claiming it was a hate crime, they have not come back on their statements, and they have not released official stories saying we were actually incorrect and we made false allegations and we are sorry.
You know, really, this is interesting because two things. First, you know, I noticed also in this case, Nardine reported it to the guards inside, and they just didn't do anything. Actually, they, if anything, they surrounded her or they tried to do something there. And the police also didn't intervene, although she reported it to the police. Am I correct?
Yeah, in fact, that is absolutely correct. And not just that, Nardine and others, her peers, they reported this to guards and the police. No one listened to them, and the police actually, they walked away with Petluck and his group, the group of Zionists.
Uh-huh.
So this demonstrates. Nardine actually wrote about the structural racism from police against Palestinian and Arab and Muslim women. And in her statement this year, I'll actually quote it right here because I have the article up. She says, quote, "It's exhausting being a Palestinian Muslim woman in this world. Mm-hmm. Cops only exist to protect certain kinds of people, mm-hmm. especially in New York City. I'm not one of those people," end quote. Yeah. So really here we just see how, speaking of all these issues that we've discussed in this interview so far, we really see how they intersect, and that's why intersectionality is so important, because the racism we're talking about that manifests itself in the killing of Mike Brown is the same racism that leads cops to not listen to Nardine, but listen to the member of the group who assaulted her in the first place, when he's the one who cries racism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and really, you know, obviously, you know, when a Zionist cries anti-Semitism, the police jumps and the institution of the U.S. jumps. But again, you know, this is a part of mutual interest, really, I believe. Or what do you think? Is this action a result of Zionist influence in the U.S., or is it also part of the racist attitude of the police and the institutions, and I don't know if you can call it the culture in the U.S. To you know, discriminate against Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians, and you know, create fear around the American of Arab and Muslim and Palestinian origin, or is it both, really, Ben? What do you think?
I wouldn't say. I think there's this tendency popular among some people, which I try to stray away from, which I think is problematic, and that's talking about the tremendous political influence of Jewish Americans and Zionist groups in the U.S. I think that's not helpful, and I think in some ways that leads to problematic conspiracy theories and such. I think what's much more constructive is looking at, is recognizing that, yes, Zionist political organizations such as AIPAC, to name one of the most powerful ones, have huge, huge influences. And Zionist Christian organizations, of which there are several, and this is kind of led by Christians United for Israel, CUFI, mm-hmm. These organizations do have a large impact, and what's interesting is that in the case of CUFI, there are very, very few Jewish members, but it's a violently pro-Israel, really racist Zionist organization. They do influence public policy, yeah. And they do lead the U.S. to funnel all this money to Israel, but I think that's kind of missing the forest for the trees in some ways. I think the real issue is just looking at U.S. imperialism.
Yeah.
The reason the U.S. is so willing to support Israel is not because of some vast Zionist conspiracy, but because Israel helps the U.S. maintain hegemony over the Middle East.
Mm.
If Israel weren't there, the U.S. does still have Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia sometimes does things the U.S. doesn't really want it to, as we saw recently with Biden's comments about Saudi Arabia funding Salafi groups.
Mm-hmm.
And Israel, until recently, until Netanyahu has kind of gone off the deep end and now just does whatever he wants regardless of what the U.S. says, until recently, the Israel was, as many people call it, kind of the watchdog of the U.S. in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about how this policy has repercussions here at home, mm-hmm. it's really an extension of the same logic of of political persecution and of racist persecution. It's not necessarily that, in my view, that there's a large, some kind of like Zionist control over the police, although it's true that some police forces train in Israel. It's actually, it's even simpler than that. It's the fact that people who oppose Israel and oppose its policies of racism and settler colonialism are seen as apologists of terrorism, or seen as apologists of violence, of political violence, of things like that, which is, of course, ridiculous, but that's just how the logic in this racist society goes. It's the world of the so-called war on terror,
yes.
where if you say you support Palestine and support Palestinian human rights,
yes.
people automatically think that you justify suicide bombs or that you justify any of these things. And that is, of course, absolutely ridiculous, but it just demonstrates the kind of, like, black and white thinking, the Manichaean thinking of U.S. politics that says you either support this entity or you are against it. And, you know, that is literally what President Bush said. He said, you're with us or you are against us.
No,
so when it comes to issues,
yeah.
right?
I agree with you. I think, you know, you put it very eloquently that it's part of the imperialist, domination or quest for domination of the Middle East, and they do anything really to try to discredit people who are opposing them. But when I said the Zionist influence, Ben, I meant I included the Zionist Christian influence in the U.S., which includes the 70 million of them, not just 6 million, 70 million of them.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and the same here, we face here in Canada, the same Zionist Christians who are really, you know, out to bring Armageddon to the area, you know, and they don't hide it. So, you know, I think there is Zionist influence inside the institutions, and that affects the decision of the policemen or the courts. Like, for example, you know, there was a rule by a judge just a couple of days ago about Rasmiya Ode, you know, and the judge Drain agreed that Rasmiya's assertion that he faced torture and sexual abuse at the hands of her Israeli captors is credible, but then he contradicted himself and he said it cannot. He had a ruling. It says it cannot be brought up in the course of her trial. I mean, isn't that? I mean, it's ridiculous the way they're dealing. You know, even in the justice system. I mean, obviously they have influence if they are impartial. He won't say such stupid things. You know, I mean, you can't use this evidence in your trial, and her trial is based on her arrest in Israeli jails. The same, like 40% of Palestinian adults who went through Israeli jails. That's almost 750,000 since the occupation started in 67. So I think it's essential that people understand that there is not just Zionist influence, but also institutional racism, which, like you talked about it at the beginning, you know, against Native people, against Black African Americans who are, discriminated against just because of the color of their skin and their ethnic background.
Yes, I think you raise, like, a really important point here, and that's just looking at structural racism in the justice system in general. Mm. And like you said, Rasmiya Ode, that case is absolutely horrible, and it demonstrates the racism against people of color in general in the U.S., but if we're talking about structural racism against people of color in Israel and the U.S., a classic example is looking at the instance of mass incarceration. And I remember reading an article saying that approximately 1 in 3 Palestinian men have been or at one point will be in an Israeli prison.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., you have very similar statistics with black men. So it's very interesting to see how the U.S. and Israel are very similar in regards to their structural racism,
mm-hmm.
and that in the U.S., many scholars have written about what they call the new Jim Crow mass incarceration, and Michelle Alexander of Ohio State is kind of like the leading figure in those regards.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the policies that the U.S. uses, illegalizing immigration and imprisoning mass numbers of immigrants, mainly Latino immigrants, And then also the war on drugs, which is very targeted at communities of color and at impoverished communities, and very disproportionately affects Black Americans, even though white Americans use drugs at the same rate. These policies are, as you point out, very similar to Israeli policies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just demonstrates how white supremacy is a global issue.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And it's something that that when the State of Israel was founded by European settler colonialists, they took that racism that was kind of endemic to Western society.
Yeah,
and they implemented it in a state that that created policies that reflected their racism.
Which again comes from a supremacist ideology, you know, that were prevalent in Europe, looking at the Third World in general. But don't you think also, Ben, that there is a special targeting for pro-Palestinian activists, like the case of Salaita, the case of Ayman Shahadi, the case of Aryan, in, you know, where he was arrested for so many years and then found not guilty of anything, really. But there is a target, and there is a collaboration between the Zionists and the institution in the U.S. to target Palestinian activists and Palestinian support you know, groups and professors and students. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I may phrase it a little differently, but absolutely. I think when we're looking at the incredible bias of the justice system in, of course, not just Israel and not even just the U.S., but the West in general, it's incredibly biased against Palestinians, but also people of Arab descent and people from Muslim-majority cultures.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., it is ridiculous the kinds of charges that completely innocent Palestinian, Saudi, Syrian, etc., refugees or immigrants to the U.S. face. There are many instances of Arab Americans getting arrested for having things and going through airplane security and having things like kettle pots, or having like a rice cooker. Like, there are actually, I've read numerous articles about young Arab men getting arrested for having a rice cooker because people say, or a pressure cooker, because people say, oh, it's going to be used for as a bomb, etc. So, absolutely, the racism and discrimination against Arabs in the justice system is appalling, and especially when they express support of Palestine, and especially, even more than that, when they express support of Palestinian resistance movements.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that here with the shockingly harsh and stringent persecution of the group CARE, the Council for American and Islamic Relations. And they talk about, there are many stories talking about how members of that organization have been monitored by the U.S. government illegally. All of their emails have been checked because the U.S. is trying to, in this kind of McCarthyist attack on anyone who supports Palestine, they're trying to find connections in some way, no matter how loose, to Palestinian resistance organizations.
Although,
and then if they can find some kind of connection, they call you a terrorist.
Yeah.
And in post 9/11 America, in post 9/11 world, when you call someone a terrorist, they're politically and untouchable. You can't save them in any way because it's just, it turns people's brains off.
Yeah,
when someone is accused of being a terrorist, it's the end.
Yeah, although it's clear the Palestinian resistance movement didn't create Al-Qaeda or the ISIS. It's the America and their allies that created these terrorist organizations. And, you know, with the support of Israel, I don't know if you've seen the headline today in Haaretz. It says, West making big mistake in fighting ISIS, says senior Israeli officer. The IDF Northern Command officer says he thinks the U.S.-led coalition intervened too early against the Sunni militants. You know, so they really, you know, they turn on and off the tap whenever they want, you know, and they created those, as the history documented, the U.S. support for these terrorist organizations, from Al-Qaeda to the recent recent manifestation of Al-Qaeda, the ISIS, through their agent regime in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and Turkey, the NATO ally, quote-unquote.
Oh, absolutely. I think sometimes I think these claims are they're somewhat exaggerated, but they're absolutely true, and that's the consistent U.S. and Israeli and Saudi policy for the past, really, 30 years has been in order to prevent a secular left-wing resistance from organizing against their imperialism, the solution has been to fund and arm counter-revolutionary reactionary, often extremist organizations. And like you mentioned, you can see in how U.S. policies has, in many ways, helped spawn Al-Qaeda and groups like this. And the classic example of this is in with the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, the U.S. support for the Mujahideen, who, of course, later became leading members of the Taliban and things like that. And you know, this goes back for decades, as I said.
Actually, Osama bin Laden was the financier for the Mujahideen in collaboration with the CIA and the Saudi regime,
And there are, of course, photos of the Mujahideen in Reagan's office.
Yeah.
And there's often, people say this this quote that's actually taken out of context, but it's a similar idea. Reagan, when he was also supporting the Contras, which were basically the same thing in Latin America, he said that the Contras were, quote, the moral equivalent of the founding fathers. And people often claim that he said that about the Mujahideen. He didn't actually, but it's still the same sentiment. While he was supporting these groups, he called them, powerful moral forces, and that's because it was part of this Cold War doctrine of destroying any kind of secular left-wing resistance that might challenge their imperialism. And actually, I mean, a classic example of this is looking at the Palestinian resistance itself. The U.S. attack on the PLO and the destruction of the PLO, and of course Israel's similar attack, is very well documented.
Yeah.
And although Hamas today is completely different from what it was when it was formed, people forget that in 1987 when it formed, Israel was involved in helping it create itself, and this is actually incredibly well documented, and it's even reported in mainstream corporate media. And the Wall Street Journal had an article, and it was called, quote, this is the name of the Wall Street Journal article, "How Israel Helped to Spawn Hamas."
Yeah.
And they talk about how the policy, in order to destroy the Palestinian resistance, was explicitly one where the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia and these other countries would fund the reactionary groups in order to have internal skirmishes that prevent the PLO and other left-wing resistance organizations from being successful.
Yes.
So as you said, yes, this goes back a while, and it is a continuous policy that the U.S. imported from other parts of the world, that the U.S. imported from Latin America, the U.S. imported from Africa. And again, when you see these connections in terms of history and in terms of policy, you see how this is all just part of imperialism, and how this process can be understood by studying this history, and hopefully by studying this history, you can therefore find effective ways to resist this imperialism and to resist this racism.
What I see more threatening than supporting these terrorist organizations is supporting these autocratic regimes that rule with the support of the U.S. Military and U.S. arming them and U.S. suppressing the popular resistance movement, whether Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, or Kuwait, you name it, all in the Arab Gulf. But this is another topic, and really was...
On that issue, actually, just really quickly, that is an incredibly important issue. And I wrote this article for Socialist Worker a few weeks ago, and the name of the article is JSIL, the Jewish State of Israel in the Levant, which was this kind of internet, especially Twitter trend that was going on, comparing Israel to ISIS and showing how many similarities there are. And I wrote this article in a scholarly way, showing that actually seriously, ISIL or ISIS has a lot of similarities to Israel. And one of the points I make throughout the article is I draw from the work of Iqbal Ahmad, the scholar, the political scientist and historian. And in that article, I mentioned some of his work from his book, Terrorism, Ours vs. Theirs. Yes. And in that book, he does a kind of scholarly study of terrorism. And he posits five kinds of terrorism. And he says, the worst kind of terrorism that no one ever talks about is state terrorism. And like you said, the U.S. support and other countries' support, the U.K. support and before that French and British support, imperialist support for these horrible autocrats around the world, for these horrible draconian repressive regimes, is itself a form of terrorism.
Yeah, it's
the U.S. has funded every dictator in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, their policies absolutely constitute a magnitude of terrorism that is thousands and thousands of times worse than these small terrorist organizations.
And they have schools to train them, like the schools of the assassins.
The Americas.
The schools of the Americas, yeah. No, I agree with you. And thank you, really. It was a pleasure talking to you, Ben. And we'll make sure I read that article you mentioned, and I encourage people to look it up at your website. We're going to put a link to your website on our Voice of Palestine, so I encourage people to go to your website and read the many articles, excellent articles you wrote on the subject of racism and subject of oppression all over the world. And thank you again, and again, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure, and I'd be happy to come on any other time.
Thank you, Ben.
And that was Hanna Kawas talking with U.S. writer and activist Ben Norton. And with that, we conclude another edition of The Voice of Palestine. Please check out our website, voiceofpalestine.ca, where we have archives of all our shows for over 10 years. Thanks for tuning in, and Palestine will be free. Money.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment here on 90.3 FM Newton that's part of Truth and Justice Radio, which airs every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope that you will join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.